Well, under the general heading of the oration of the Emperor Julian, we want to make a little study of the religions of the world and their very strongly feminine emphasis, and in bringing in certain examples which will indicate clearly that the original revelations of most faiths were not primarily a masculine revelation. This has developed gradually over a series of ages by various causes which are gradually being changed. The probabilities are that among the most ancient peoples to recognize the priority of the feminine principle were on this continent. Most of the Indians along the east seaboard who belonged to the Great League of the Iroquois were very strongly overshadowed by the feminine principle. The women of the tribes elected all of the officials, and the men had no vote. And having no vote, the government went along very pleasantly. The women elected the senators. The men did not vote. The senators, in turn, carried out the legislations of the tribes. But there was another interesting point, which I think has considerable political influence in our modern time, and that is that the political representatives of the various tribes were not permitted by law to have a ballot on their own tribe. When the Congress gathered, each senator could vote on anything that did not concern his own tribe. The others had to vote that. So that there was very little opportunity of working up a strong lobby. In fact, there never was any trace of one. Also, another interesting point in connection with this was that the dealings political were very gentle. It is against the law to argue in the tent or kibi where the council was held. Everyone had to treat every other delegate with courtesy, patience, and honor. It was a very interesting situation, a very matriarchal culture, and it has been expressed by a number of modern observers that if the colonists had come 50 years later, they could not have dominated America. It was just one of those things destined by fate. But it was definite and evident evidence that there was a strong matriarchal culture on our own hemisphere. In other parts of the world, we see similar peculiar situations arising in the development of religious beliefs. In almost all religions, there was at least one prominent feminine divinity. Very often, she was the most important of all. In the ancient Greek and Roman Empire, Athena, or Minerva, goddess of wisdom, of truth, and of law, was the presiding spirit. In another case, for instance, of course, in the Nordic and Gothic rites, Brunhilde, the daughter of Odin, was the mind maiden of the law. Was the one that was given the authority to discriminate between the levels of justice and also to select the heroes who were to have a special place in the afterlife. This goes on and on from one group to another, and we find practically no evidence anywhere of lack of this consideration. In Egypt, of course, Isis was the mother of mysteries. She presided completely over the esoteric arts and sciences of Egypt. She was the one who was called upon under all conditions for the highest aspects of learning, understanding, and at Sais, on her statue, it was stated that she was the mother of the sun, S-U-N. This is another peculiar situation because all through the rites and mysteries, the feminine principle has been associated with and is identical with the mystical religions. The esoteric arts, alchemy, and those types of mysticism are all feminine dominated in their beginnings and developments. The transmutation of life was left to be a part of the feminine contribution to existence. Therefore, it's not unusual or unreasonable that we should explore some of the beliefs and doctrines relating to this subject. I think we may begin, of course, with the Emperor Julian. His great essays, in honor of celebrating the Mother of the Gods, is a tremendous document, but very subtle. Julian was not a great Platonist, but he was devoted to the works of Proclus, the Platonic successor, and had intended to devote his life to study. But being raised suddenly to the purple by situations beyond his control, he had to divide his attention between the duties of state and the advancement of his philosophic life. He had very little time to do this, as he only survived 2 years under the role of emperor. He then was killed in a battle in Persia, where he was defending the outlying areas of the Roman Empire. So Julian settled down very quietly to study Platonic mysticism, something that was perhaps best expressed through Proclus and Plotinus. The mysticism of Plato was a strange and rather intriguing subject about which very little is known and very much less is discussed. It is a part of a doctrine that Plato developed himself, in which he pointed out that all forms of knowledge must lead back to the source of knowledge, whether this source of knowledge is in the individual or in the universe. All knowledge must ascend to its source or cause, and its source or cause is a mystical divinity. Plato was completely convinced that all intellection is futile unless it enlifts the soul to communion with the mystery of its own inner existence. Julian tells us, for example, that the Mother of the Gods was called Night. Now, this is a very peculiar thing to think of, but perhaps it is interesting to realize that according to Julian's interpretation of Plato, Night was the beginning of everything. In the beginning was darkness, and darkness was not emptiness. Darkness was not despair. Darkness was a totality of an unmanifested reality. Night was rest. It was peace. Night was the time when the illusions of the outer life are more or less suspended. Night is the time when the soul has for a time dominion over both the mind and the body. And the soul, according to Julian, was the Mother of the Gods. The soul then becomes tremendously important, not only in Platonic mysticism, but in all those branches which more or less sprang from this root. The Mother of the Gods then, being universal soul, the absolute intelligible, that which is, whether known or not known, that which is above and beyond the mind, that which can be reached by the mind only by an extension of itself into mysticism. The Mother of the Gods, therefore, represents the totality of the divine plan. It is the Mother that brought forth the Son. It is the Mother that brought forth the orders and hierarchies of deities, divinities, and subdivinities. All these were produced out of the darkness of the great primordial mystery, the mystery of absolute soul power. Now, in practical thinking, Julian believed that the soul in man is the night in him. It is the mysterious psychic darkness. It is that which is beyond description and definition. It is this soul that remains more or less suspended, not allowed to manifest itself, locked within the intellectual of the mental faculties. But the mind is not the soul. The mind is subservient to the soul. And the only purpose of mind is to fulfill the search for soul. The mind must die on the threshold of divinity. The mind, with its constant conflicts, its various conflicting ideas and attitudes, the points of view which are irreconcilable, and the vast effort to integrate a material existence in a spiritual world. We are coming onto this problem again in our present age. We are seeing the inevitable sorrow of the mind-governed universe. And Dugin was aware of this. And while he was part of a mind-governed empire, he realized the basic weakness from which almost all human beings suffer. The effort to create in an area of illusion that which can only exist in total reality. So in the discussion of the Mother of the Gods, we find Julian explaining and interpreting to the best of his ability, and his abilities were considerable, the problem of the restoration of grace, the restoration of the soul as the leader of life. As long as the mind governs life, it will lead to a material confusion. And until the confusion is solved by the elevation of the mind above the realm of material pressures, we will never have an enduring culture. So Julian wanted the individual to realize that all this vast pageantry which we see around us, this tremendous complication of invention and art and literature and science, industry, law, economics, medicine, all these things belong to the intellectual sphere. And because of that, they are all subject to constant change, and they are subject to eternal emendation. Everything we know demands more study to find out more about it. Every belief we have lingers for a time and is then canceled out by another belief. Every empire we build falls from its own inevitable weakness. Every successful person comes in the end to failure, unless he has made the bridge between his life and the eternal life within him. It follows, therefore, that in taking Julian's point of view down into our present worldly condition, that he is telling us that there are two kinds of knowledge, one that governs the day and the other that governs the night. There are two kinds of lives that we all live, the life of waking and the life of sleep. In the life of waking, our own attitudes govern all things. In the act of sleep, we come back again to the universal law which created us, must dominate us, and must ultimately lead us to redemption. Therefore, sleep becomes a symbol of letting go of fantasy. It is the individual reaching inward to the eternal peace of his own soul. For it is in sleep that the soul is awake, and it is in waking that the soul is mostly asleep. In our daily activities, we depend entirely upon the alertness of the intellect, but in sleep we depend upon a detachment from the objects of mind and the objects of emotion. If we do not achieve this detachment, we suffer from insomnia, and if it is continued, we suffer from psychological disorders of one kind or another. Therefore, the real life of the person is in sleep. But in order to understand this, we have to also recognize that in the sleep phenomena as we know it, it is still burdened very heavily by intellection. The individual going to sleep has dreams, and these dreams may often be complicated and difficult. These dreams are not part of the true sleep of the Great Mother. They are parts of a nightmare in which the half-awake, half-asleep person struggles with the complications of a mortal existence. They become symbolical of weaknesses and attitudes within the person. Now, as in mysticism, meditation is regarded with great favor, and various exercises of quietude, as in Zen, are cultivated in Oriental peoples. All of these quieting activities, the various beliefs of quietist denominations and sects, all lead to one natural conclusion, namely that quietude and peace is the bridge between the outside and the inside. It is only, as the Chinese said long ago, the sage who sleeps without dreams. Now, this sleeping without dreams gradually takes on another phase. This sleep gradually becomes a source not only of the rebuilding of physical life, but of the reorientation of the individual in a universe in which form plays very little part. The internal life of the person, guided by the mystery of the Divine Mother, is led gradually back to the second birth. In Isis, in Egypt, we have the perfect example of this phenomenon. Isis was not only the mysteries, but Isis was the mother of mysteries. And all of these great institutions of initiation were a part of her life. From her womb came the adepts and the masters and the great teachers. She was the mother of all that was good, all that was wise, and all that was inevitable. And also she was the mother of the illumined child, Horus, the son of Osiris and Isis, the son of life and light, of light and darkness, of day and night. And Julian, in his essay to the Sovereign Son, devotes considerable space also to this problem. But actually, as has been said in many religions, the human being is subject to a double birth. He is born physically into the material world by the various laws of nature and the environment in which he finds himself. But he has a second birth into the inner world of life, into the temple, into the mysteries, into the secret parts of the world governed over by the mother of mysteries. Therefore, we may feel at this time that the search for the solution to our present worldly problem, if we acted on the advice of Julian, the answer would be still and know that I am God. Instead of trying to angle our way in and out of situations, instead of great conflicts and conversations that mean little or nothing, all real solutions come from quietude, from the individual reaching back into his own soul, which is the mother of his life. And each person in their daily existence and their daily experience has need of the comforting power of the world mother. And this mother has not only male and children, but female children. And all of these children have the same mother. Therefore, all arts and sciences are from the same source. Everything that is good has come from the great mother. Everything that is not good is the result of man trying to separate himself from the inevitable plan to which he belongs. Now, the comforting power of truth has been recognized from the beginning, and we can come into the spheres of alchemy for transmutation and for all the regenerations of life. We are in an emergency now, a very difficult one, in which we are suddenly discovering to our dismay that intellection is not going to solve our problem. The mind is a servant of bodily needs. The mind is the servant of the excesses which we have cultivated. The mind does everything that it can to support its own mistakes. It tries desperately to maintain its own self-centered, selfish purposes. And this mind is therefore a negative mind. It is a mind of the abyss. It is a false darkness, a darkness arising not from the source of life, but from the source of error. And we find this picked up later by St. Augustine, and a great deal made of it in the early Christian church. But in the main problem, we have this. We are going to keep on fighting, apparently. We're going to have new laws. We're going to elect new senates, new representatives. We're going to do everything we can to find a solution that will bring peace and happiness without interfering in any way with our own personal right to be wrong. We want to go on doing as we do and have legislation protect us. We are, in a sense, we might say, infantile delinquents. We are not obeying the parental pattern. And because of our way of living today, we have turned our minds, hearts, and energies away from that pattern. We are trying desperately to evade the pressure of right. We do not care whether we are right or wrong. We are physically tied up in a situation where many people are drinking themselves to death, fully knowing what they're doing, but have so decided. Others are suffering from narcotics addiction. Others are in all types of crime, including suicide, simply because they are going to do exactly what they intend to do. The terror and tragedy of the consequence is around all of us every minute, but the delinquent continues to be delinquent. This is because he does not, in his own life, have the energies, the powers, or the insights to take care of the precious gifts that the universe has bestowed upon him. He insists on doing it his way. Now, in trying to combat this, we have people rising on all sides, trying to find answers to these problems. The only answer remains to relax back as far as is humanly possible into the divine plan as it continues throughout all time and all space. We must come back again into the arms of the Great Mother. We must find the only peace there is in the devotion and dedication to those principles which are immutable, inevitable, and eternal. Thus, we can see around us a need today for Julian's point of view. We can see that as a ruler of an empire for only 2 years before he was killed in battle, Julian was fully aware of the tragedy of the time. He knew also the tragedy of his own life. He believed in reincarnation and believed that in a previous embodiment he had been Alexander the Great. And as both lives were almost parallel, there seems to be some support to this hypothesis. But Julian was convinced that we live again, and that in reliving, we become a little better and a little wiser. For a time again, we go to sleep in the Great Mother, the Mother being the silence of mortal things, which permits the sound of life to be heard. Somewhere behind the confusion is the harmony of the spheres. Somewhere behind all the illegalities with which we are burdened is a simple pattern of universal law. A law that is equal in its love for all that lives, is sustaining all life with a benevolence and abundance which we ignore and forget. And so Julian took it for granted that the best and most advantageous course was to search again within ourselves for the soul which is the source of us. He believed that the soul is in each person, that the Great Mother abides in each of us. Man and woman alike has the Great Mother principle within its deepest and most esoteric parts. The Great Mother is therefore the silent sufferer for most of the mistakes that we daily make and which we continue to make regardless of our own opportunities to improve. So Julian cultivated and recommended the cultivation of a retrospective life, a life in which, while the mind is active, it deals with the principles of intelligibles rather than intellectuals. A small child, as we have said, is sometimes born much wiser than when he grows up. We also know that a large part of our so-called growth is in a false direction. We are not nearly as real as after we have been educated in material matters. We are not nearly as kind, as gentle, as wise in mysteries as we were when we were children. So that the child heart, as it has been called, is really the soul locked in us. It is the soul power that can never speak loudly, can never shout or cry, can never defend itself by any objective action, but which must remain quiet until we caught it by our own integrities. But to go back further into ourselves is best in peace. And for most persons, the best time for this peace is when they approach sleep. Because in sleep, the individual has a certain freedom from the pressures of externals. The path upward to union with the goddess is still obscure. But in sleep, we begin to feel something. We feel the very great truth that when we stop thinking too hard, we become better people. We find that by relaxing away from the pressures of the day, forgetting for a moment what we owe and who owes us, we do gain a certain rest. Now, if the pressure of outside things is so great that it disturbs sleep, we will very rapidly pass into a serious condition. It is therefore very advisable to watch and guide sleep as the beginning of a religion, the religion of rest, the religion not of laziness, but a religion of suspending the external and allowing the internal to manifest itself through us. To the degree that we depart from fallacy, reality has a chance. And in reality, we have not the intellectuals, but the intelligibles. Now, the intelligibles, according to Julian, are the immutable principles of life. The Platonists have another peculiar doctrine which seems to be strange to us, and that is that there is nothing in the universe that is not alive. Now, when we think of lives, we think of plants or animals or something of that nature. But to the Greeks, they included everything. Summer is alive. Winter is alive. Water, fire, air are alive. The air is alive. Clouds and storms are not simply masses of foam in the sky. They are actually parts of living creatures. The whole world is made up of life. Nothing is inorganic completely. But every form that exists in nature, from a rock up or down, has something alive in it. There is a life in all of these things. And the cultivation of the proper use of these things is indispensable to the preservation of humanity. Now we are beginning to wonder what is happening to our natural resources. We are still trying to find a place to dump our garbage. This is what is part of what Julian was aiming at, namely, that everything that exists has use and abuse. Everything has to be done well, or sorrow is inevitable. Every law has to be kept, or the lawbreaker suffers. Now, man-made laws have been more or less accepted as substitutes for divine law, but they are not substitutes and never can be. There would be no need for human laws if divine laws were understood and applied. Now, how are we going to get at these divine laws? Well, Julian, being a Platonist, and also practicing the Platonic disciplines, stated very quietly, and others after him, that there is a journey in life, a pathway that leads from the outer to the inner. This pathway twists through a complex structure of beliefs, opinions, doctrines. It also twists through all kinds of living forms, energies, principles, minerals, vegetables, medical interests and everything. Everything is part of one great living structure. And this living structure is based also upon a simple principle: use and survive, abuse and die. This is the point that Julian tries to make from a philosophic standpoint. Everything in the universe means something. And everything in the universe has to be used as it was intended to be used, or tragedy will follow.
So ignorance may be, therefore, considered the absence of the realization that it is necessary to live above by a code above that of human society. Human society may carry us part of the way, but our great destiny rests in something beyond this. It rests in our gradual coming into the rules and principles of eternal life. While we have a few years here, we are immortal beings. And as immortal beings, we are faced with an eternity before us. And in this eternity, politics and all the various superficial attitudes of people have very little meaning. By the time we come back, there will be an entirely different human structure, which we will again desperately try to adjust to our own feelings and beliefs. We will try to work out the particular little schemes of ourselves in an environment which is not really fit for them. But we will try to keep breaking laws of some kind in order to enjoy what we call freedom. There is no freedom, as also we find in the Platonic dialogues, there is no freedom in the world except that which results from breaking no laws. Freedom is the individual's voluntary adjustment with a purpose for himself, his acceptance of the reality of his own mission, the realization that he is an embodiment of a divine power, and as long as he lives in harmony with that embodiment, he will be happy. When he goes against the embodiment, he is in much greater trouble than when he goes against man-made statutes. For when he goes against his own inner life, he corrupts that part of himself which is most necessary and most valuable. So under these conditions, we see something of his idea of the world mother. The world mother is this soul that guards everything, guides everything, and actually brings forth from itself all of the deities. It is actually true, as in Egypt, that it is the great mother that brings forth the light of day. For light is a gift of the spirit. Light is something that is necessary to our well-being, and therefore, being necessary, it is available. Therefore, Julian says that the great mother is the mother of light, the mother of the gods, and the mother of the world. Now, to feel a sense of the presence of the maternal principle, we begin to look into the moral codes of life. Ideally, most of our laws are just, but we do not keep them. Ideally, the human being is kind, but very often it is profitable to be unkind. Under normal conditions, without pressures, the average person is reasonably content with life. But under artificial pressures, this contentment is disturbed and may end in rebellion and revolution. So it is to get again into this principle of life and love. Another attribute of the Divine Mother is beauty. Beauty is harmony. Harmony is peace. Beauty is the natural instinct of the human being to produce from himself beautiful things. This is the negative pole. What is wanted is that he will produce from himself a beautiful self, his own. Beauty is an element, a being, a goddess, and all ancient peoples believed these principles were deities or semi-deities. So beauty becomes an aspect of the power of the Great Mother. And a good example of that was perhaps found in the story of the Crusades. During the Middle Ages, there was a great religious upheaval in effort to bring the Holy Sepulchre back into the domain of Christendom. Several Crusades were launched to accomplish this. All failed. And the most terrible, perhaps, of all was the Child's Crusade, when small children went into the desert to die of starvation and just inability to survive. But when these crusades got underway, the knights and the princes and the earls and the dukes and all the petty monarchs with their retainers and all their officers got together and made a great military body to lead the way of the resurrection or restoration of the Holy Sepulchre. They went out and they fought for years, and most of them died out there. Some came back, but there was a very heavy mortality. In the meantime, what happened at home? The ladies took over the management of the castles. They took over the ways and works of their husbands who were away and may never come back. They found that it was impossible to take care of all the duties of management, except for one thing. It was noticeable among these people that most of these ladies were tired of castles filled with armament in which practically the only relaxation was fighting. They felt that it was time to make things a little more homelike, and believe it or not, they did it. And while their husbands were away, they brought in tapestries, beautiful carpets, paintings, objects of art, grace, all kinds of activities, dancing, music, theater, all these things came while hubbies were away from home. And from that time on, home was no longer a kind of dungeon. It became a place of pleasure and pleasantness. It became a place where people could dream pleasant dreams, undertake pleasant activities, develop hidden talents, and become more sociable and likable, and take far better and more conscious care of their children. So from that time on, woman's place in the advancement of civilization became permanent, because to her was entrusted a number of values, one of which was beauty, one of which was a desire to make things more lovely, to grow gardens, to do all kinds of things that make the earth more pleasant to live in. Well, this type of beauty, involving soul beauty, psychic beauty, also became part of the new order of life, which was seeking to find soul within body. Beauty was a manifestation of soul, not its full manifestation, but it was a release of something that was in there that had been locked in there for thousands of years through the mistakes and misfortunes of human society. So now beauty came forth as a modifying, modernizing factor. But beauty soon got mixed up with the material objectives, and the first thing you know, art became overly expensive, much of it very decadent and uninspiring. And the great gift of beauty, which we find in the classic works of the antiquity, both East and West, gradually died out because people didn't protect it. They didn't recognize beauty as a soul power. They gradually reduced it to a merchandise. And this was a very serious and great mistake against the growth of human beings. But beauty was there in spite of all this, and beauty was part of soul. And beauty was a transforming, transmuting agent that changed material things that were rather crude and objectionable into something acceptable and, in many cases, truly grand. We find this especially in religion, where the great cathedrals and churches came into existence, where the various rites and rituals of religion were glorified and made beautiful and wonderful. But as time went on, this beauty, these achievements were not enough. We found the individual falling back into another trap, the trap of the constant pressure of material purpose. They say, and probably it is true, that the great cause of this, of course, is that no average person is aware of the continuity of his own existence. He has to take immortality on faith. But a quick job on the business level is very factual here and now. It is one thing to make a million here, and another to hope for grace in the life to come. And too many people have no imagination in these matters. They do not realize the inevitable transition that must come. They do not realize that they are capable, if they have the insight and the understanding, of moving tranquilly from one life to the other. but even with the best of those who are now struggling for enlightenment, the pressure of the mortal mind, so to say, is too strong. Things become matters of suffering in terms of material value. And behind all of this is the quiet, gentle, gracious radiance of the Mother of Mysteries, the soul. Now, there are various answers to what is soul. This is one of the things that has been much debated. Julian was of the opinion that the soul, being a phase or manifestation of night, that soul was the absolute existence itself. Soul was the eternal, unchangeable, immutable, inevitable reality. Soul was infinite good, capable of appearing in an infinite group of manifestations of good. Soul was reality. All the rest is in some ways strangely, vaguely unreal. And that which we call unreal is the great reality. And in this, Julian gives us some other interesting thoughts. As the one eternal reality, and being, as so to say, in every individual, the living spirit of himself, the unchangeable life of his own spirit, this being true, the person in his daily life is living out of a reservoir of soul energy. Behind every anger is peace. Behind every uncouth word is gentleness. Somewhere behind all of the confusion of mortal existence is the immutable, inevitable fact of infinite love. So now love comes in. Soul loves. The soul is the instrument of love in all things. And the soul of its own nature, waiting patiently, imprisoned within this fantastic constitution of living creatures. The soul is infinite love in infinite manifestation. In other words, Julian would have said that sleep or night or darkness is actually absolute love. It is that which is behind everything. It is that which moves every reality, every legal, lawful move in the unfoldment of human destiny is motivated by love. All of the crimes have been built of hate, indifference, selfishness, stupidity, and things of this nature. But all the great good things have come from love. And those whom we most remember as the great teachers of our race were those who so loved their humanity that they gave their life to the service of it. Love, therefore, is another aspect of the Mother of Mysteries. Now, love is a strange thing because it is not what we ordinarily call love. It is not a physical thing. Love can manifest under certain conditions physically, and a manifestation of its physical reality is also very noble and important. But love in turn of the infinite is this love of life for life, reality for reality, eternity for eternity. It is something that is there always. And we ascend the ladder of love as we ascend the ladder of the sciences, step by step. Plotinus tells us, there are several degrees of love. There are loves that are selfish, loves that are unselfish. But the greatest of all love is the love of God and the love of truth.